This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We live in times with faint hopes amid darkening despair. This week, an ancient cathedral burned. A criminal politician got away with it. We pump millions of tons of global warming into the atmosphere. More species staggered towards extinction. And a 16-year-old girl tried to wake Europe and the world. In this program, NASA scientist Peter Kalmus explains how he slashed 90% of his personal emissions. Senior South American reporter Sue Branford warns the Amazon rainforest, the lungs of the planet, is not just dying, it is being murdered. Then we will hear 16-year-old Greta Thunberg's speech to the European Parliament. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock.
Down here on the corner of ruin and grace, I'm growing weary of the human race. Hold my lamp up in everyone's face, looking for an honest man. Everyone tied to the turning wheel, everyone hiding from the things they feel. Truth's so hard, it just don't seem real. The shadow across this land.
We are destroying the life support systems our children and grandchildren will need. We don't mean to, but we do. Something has to change, and author Peter Kalmus says it's us. I need to be the change. You need to be the change. Peter Kalmus is a hybrid. By day, he is a published climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in California. The rest of the time, Peter and his wife find ways to opt out of these deadly systems, and he was named as one of the 10 visionaries in the 2018 Grist List. Peter wrote the book Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution. It is stuffed with realistic stories and charts full of tips how to get off this climate-killing ride. The book has since been turned into a film available on DVD. From Pasadena, California, Peter Kalmus, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me. I should say I'm speaking on my own behalf before we get going.
Right. Now, before we dive into alternative culture, please tell us what you do as a scientist.
So I'm an atmospheric scientist, and I'm also a data scientist. So I've spent some time studying clouds off the coast of California and other marine areas of stratocumulus clouds. So stratocumulus is overcast cloud, and it looks pretty bright from space. So it's reflecting a lot of sunlight. So depending on how that changes in the future in a warmer world, it could help mitigate global warming or it could make it worse. I also have recently started doing some work in the area of ecological forecasting. So that's using data science to help bridge the gap between the Earth system model projections of, for example, temperature, sea surface temperature, you know, other variables, and how those changes, those projected changes in the future, are going to translate to changes in our ecosystems. So in particular, I'm embarking on a three-year research adventure studying how these projected changes will affect coral reefs in greater precision than has been done before.
And you did an anonymous poll of Earth scientists. How are they handling the terrible news about climate and destruction of the biosphere?
Oh, that's a tough question, Alex. I handle it personally by trying to do everything I can to raise the awareness that this is an urgent issue. That's sort of, you know, action for me is kind of the best medicine. You know, was just talking to some of my colleagues today at a nearby university, and I gave a seminar and I talked to several of them sort of one-on-one in meetings throughout the day, and I was really surprised by how many of them were kind of on the same page as I am, at least in private, and how, you know, some of them expressed that they are, it takes a little bit of courage to speak out, but they're looking for that courage, and I think that's wonderful. I think there's been a real shift over the last few years in the earth science community, and it's tough. I mean, as scientists, we didn't necessarily get into this to speak out and to be in front of the public and to communicate about this. We, you know, most earth scientists are just fascinated by the earth system and do this work because they love it. And, you know, I'm a little bit of an anomaly. I was doing astrophysics for almost a decade, and I got increasingly concerned about climate change. So I intentionally switched into the field. But many of my colleagues, especially my older colleagues, they didn't start in earth science from a sense of urgency. They just started from a sense of fascination. And then as they're studying their system and they're seeing these changes and the implications are unfolding to them, you know, they're faced with a tough choice whether to just keep doing science or to start sounding the alarm and speaking out. And more of them are starting to choose the latter, I think, as the impacts are becoming more clear and, frankly, more frightening.
So why do you think that just laying out the science and the facts about climate change isn't going to do it? It isn't going to bring real action?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question and probably better posed to a psychologist. You know, I think there's probably a lot of reasons. If there's a problem that's kind of a very deep part of our identity, something that's either tribal or part of our worldview, perhaps, you know, if we've been working in industries that are contributing to the problem our whole lives and like really trying to make the world better, you know, and then, you know, some young people come along and say, actually, what you've been doing this whole time is making the world worse. That's not like necessarily a good thing to hear. You know, if an authority figure from perhaps for our, like a political party that we affiliate with says that it's not happening, and for whatever ideological reason we want to believe it's not happening, it makes it easy to justify that. You know, you have scientists are somewhat authority figures, but a tribal leader, someone, you know, an ideological leader that we associate more deeply with is going to take precedent over the scientists and, you know, make it easier to kind of justify throwing away the evidence or at least not examining it too closely. You know, as a scientist, I think most scientists we like evidence a lot. And, you know, a true skeptic, when presented with evidence contrary to his or her views, will change his or her views according to the strength of the evidence. That's real skepticism, and that's what science is based on. And unfortunately, a lot of the people out there who call themselves climate skeptics are actually the opposite of skeptics.
You know, you wrote in your book about something where you felt a kind of internal fracture, and that really resonated with me because while I make climate radio every week, I need to drive sometimes a couple of hours to visit our grandson, and it's very difficult to cope with the guilt of helping to harm the world, even though you don't mean harm, and that's something we all need to overcome, and I think there's a few ideas in your book that can help us do it.
You know, I tend to like to talk to people, and I'm fascinated by people who really try to find ways to reduce fossil fuel use in their life. I think that kind of exploration of how we can live with much less fossil fuel, even before the systems and the infrastructure catch up to us, it's, to me, a really curious and interesting adventure. But even though I probably rub elbows with people like that more than the average person, I have yet in my entire life to meet a single human who doesn't burn any fossil fuel. So I personally don't think purity tests or shaming are helpful in any way. But at the same time, I do think it's very useful, especially for advocates and leaders in the climate action movement. And some of them are scientists, some of them are not scientists. But if it's your goal to try to raise a sense of urgency that this is really a very urgent issue facing humanity, it's incredibly useful to start looking for ways to reduce your own fossil fuel use. And a lot of those advocates, I think, they're deeply aware of how much harm burning fossil fuel causes. So that's another good reason to look for ways to reduce. But it's important also to be gentle. For example, one of my biggest sources of emission in 2010 was my flying. And it took me 3 years to ramp it down from about 50,000 miles a year, which is pretty typical for a lot of academics, down to zero. I had to talk to my parents and kind of like change their sense of like me being able to just jump on a plane really quick and visit them. I was starting a new job and sort of had to kind of, you know, set those expectations that I wasn't going to be flying. So I still go to meetings and conferences that I can get to without flying. But, you know, it took me a while to get to that point, and it's probably easier for me to do that since I'm in Southern California. So there's a lot of opportunities to collaborate here in California. There's a lot of conferences that come, you know, right here to Pasadena, or if not to Pasadena, then maybe in the Bay Area, that are pretty easy for me to get to. And if I really need to go far afield, you know, maybe once a year I can take a very long train ride, even though that's a little bit expensive time-wise. But my point is, no matter where we are, no matter what limitations we have, what privilege we have, we can all look for ways to reduce in some ways, but it's unrealistic to expect that we can go all the way to zero until the systems and infrastructure around us catch up. And the reason it's really good for us to try to get out in front of the culture and push for reduced fossil fuel use is to try to get that kind of cultural shift and, you know, help those systems and that infrastructure to change more quickly. So if no one is basically voting with their actions to use less fossil fuel, then I think, you know, the urgency is not going to be conveyed as quickly. The exploration isn't going to happen as quickly. And, you know, the cultural shift and the system change will take longer.
How much did you manage to cut your personal carbon emissions when you set out on that adventure for the book?
About 3/4 of my emissions were from the flying. And at the same time I was cutting the flying, I changed to be a vegetarian. I looked for other ways to cut my emissions. Those were sort of the big things. Yeah, interestingly, I started to find ways to get some of my food from the waste stream, and eventually that turned into a relationship with a grocery store, which unfortunately recently ended, but for several years I was able to get food that they were going to throw away and use that to feed my family. And that, you know, good to keep that out of the landfill so it wouldn't just turn into methane. Yeah, so when I started, I was a little bit over 20 metric tons per year, which is pretty close to the average for people in the U.S. And, yeah, over several years, I managed to reduce that by about a factor of 10. So mostly due from cutting out the flying, and then changes I made to my diet were sort of the second most significant set of changes. So that was becoming vegetarian and getting some of my food from the waste stream, which eventually, you know, turned into a relationship with a local grocery store, and I went and picked up some of their spoils, what they were going to throw away. Took a little bit of for it myself, and then donated it to a local church community. So that was pretty nice. And then riding my bike was also helpful for this. And it's I love talking about biking because it's one of those things that is absolutely a delight to me. And I would keep doing a lot of it, even if there wasn't any climate change. You know, it's a great source of exercise, and I don't know if it's the way I'm wired or if it's a common thing for a lot of people, but it makes me really happy when I'm on a bike.
A listener gave me a fabulous cargo bike, and it's made in Seattle, and now I can get my groceries and other heavy stuff up to 180 pounds safely on my bike. I just think cargo bikes are a great idea.
Yeah, biking is something everyone should do. You know, as biking infrastructure gets better, you know, more protected bike lanes and more people out biking so that cars are more aware of bikers, it's only going to get safer and better. It's a, sort of a chicken and egg problem, especially here in Los Angeles. There's not a lot of biking, so there's not a lot of demand for, you know, good protected bike lanes. And so that keeps more people from biking. But it's a shame because it's such a healthy thing, actually. You know, there are very few ways to actually improve your health. If you're you know, the average person gains a lot of, you know, extra time on this planet basically just by biking because of lowered risk of heart disease, it turns out.
Yeah, it's such a shame. I mean, Vancouver just put in quite a few bike lanes. They had to fight the car people all the way. And I can see that Los Angeles is the hub of car travel. I mean, more cars are sold in California than in most countries. But it's such a shame that North America is so far behind Europe in using bicycles for clean, healthy, fossil-free transportation. It drives me crazy.
Yeah, and it's a good example of how hard it is to change the status quo, right? And that's exactly what we need to do here for getting off of fossil fuels. I mean, this is not really a technological problem or a physics problem so much as a human problem, right? We're all too accustomed to burning these fossil fuels, and we're not imaginative enough to sort of see the alternatives, which is why I think it's important for at least a few of us, and hopefully for more and more of us, to start to explore these alternatives and maybe to realize and to spread the message that it's really not so bad to live with a tenth of fossil fuel. The biggest change, I think, for most people, if they look at my lifestyle, would be giving up flying. And there's a lot I like about the no flying. And I urge people to try to fly less. You know, again, it's that sort of middle path approach where it's pretty unhelpful to tell people, you know, just stop doing something. But if everyone can try to fly a little bit less and that becomes a little bit more of the norm. For me, I was flying too much before and it was kind of exhausting. And, you know, I wasn't really part of my community here where I lived and I didn't see my, you know, kind of got homesick too often for my family. So I definitely prefer flying less. It's tough, though. I know people have to fly for their jobs. They have, you know, parents that live far away. Sometimes they have long-distance relationships. I hear that a lot, and I understand that it's tough. But the problem is, you know, the atmospheric radiative system of greenhouse gases and photons, it doesn't care why we fly. It only cares that we're emitting that CO2. That's why it's such a hard thing.
I remember being in a church hearing George Monbiot speaking in 2006. He'd written his book, Heat, and he talked about the biggest problem with flying is love miles, that you're going to see your relatives, the people that you really love. And so he said, what we're going to have to do now is look for a mate if you're going to get married or have a relationship. Look for somebody who lives close to you and try and see if their family lives close to you and try and keep your family close to you, so that you will be able to see the people you love without wrecking the atmosphere.
Absolutely, and I think that's a great example of how actually some of these changes could be better because, you know, I think with the advent of planes, we all got accustomed to living really far away from each other. I guess some people maybe don't have good relationship with their close family. That might be a good thing, but, you know, I definitely miss my parents. You know, I settled here in Los Angeles, and they're still in Chicago where I grew up. It's a bummer. You know, I wish I lived closer to them. I kind of made this move before I was so aware of the urgency of climate change. But, you know, I still manage to see them about once a year, usually by train.
Well, and didn't you drive there in a vegetable-powered car?
Yeah, several times. That was a sort of hobby of mine, to convert an old Mercedes to run on vegetable oil. And then I was fascinated with kind of how fossil fuel is hidden from plain sight. You know, you put the gas pump in your car, you don't actually realize how much stuff is going through that hose and into your tank. Same thing when you get on the plane. You don't realize just how massive all that fuel is that makes the plane go. The infrastructure, the refineries, the mining operations, it's like all kind of hidden away. So I was sort of fascinated by that. And, you know, I'm like, let me see if I can get this fuel myself. I've actually stopped driving in that car. In November, I decided to buy an electric vehicle, which I love. And it was a big decision for me because I like the hands-on sort of experience of getting my fuel myself. But what I started to like less and less was the fact that even though the used veggie oil wasn't contributing to climate change, and it was great to keep that old 1984 car on the road, I didn't like the fact that it's still making particulate pollution, which is bad for health. All the kind of garbage particles that we put into the air is going into our lungs too and making a lot of us sick and decreasing our lifespans. So I'm starting to become very aware of that, and I, you know, don't like to make the air dirty either. So yeah, the electric car is great. I actually drove that to Chicago one time, and it worked fine. It was just as easy as driving a gasoline car, and actually a lot easier than driving a waste veggie oil car because, you know, you have to worry about the fuel there and, frankly, you know, keep it from breaking down.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Peter Kalmus, the NASA scientist who tells us how to be the change, live well, and spark a climate revolution. He's speaking not for NASA here. He's speaking for himself. And I want to tell listeners, in New York, the Reverend Billy has established the Church of Stop Shopping. And you, Peter, tried out a 46-day trial of opting out of buying things. How did that go?
That was a lot of fun. That was actually my wife's idea. So we still bought food, but that was pretty much it. If there was like a kind of a serious maintenance issue, you know, maybe like a bike part or something, we'd buy that. But yeah, we basically didn't buy anything for, I think it was her idea to do it for Lent, since she observes Lent. And it was surprisingly easy. We had a Prius that we forgot to fill up, with gasoline before we started it, so there was only like 1 gallon in there. So we bartered some eggs from our chicken to a friend and siphoned some gasoline from his gas tank, which was kind of fun. It was all just done in the spirit of fun.
And this whole system, though, and you write about this in the book, is designed to make us buy, to want more things and to create more emissions. And when we try to stop, some people get very critical. They can get upset with us. They can get angry. Have you and your wife experienced pushback when you try these new things?
Probably the most pushback I get is from, buying less advocacy that I do. it's so ingrained as part of, for example, the academic lifestyle that it's pretty radical to suggest that we could fly less. And I think it feels a little bit threatening. I've found that a lot of my colleagues are actually starting to fly less. Just the other day, one of them said that he went to a panel. He flew to it, and he felt that there was a little Peter sitting on his shoulder. So I don't want to make people feel guilty, but I guess sometimes that's what happens. But then he said something really interesting, which was that, but he realized I was right, and that particular panel wasn't worth the flight. And so I think, even the people who are pushing back against the flying, it's at least getting them to start to think. And I think that's the process of changing norms. I think more and more people are starting to come around. We definitely recognize, I want to really drive this point home, that we can't solve this problem by just a bunch of people changing voluntarily. We need structural change. We need systems change. This is just one way among many ways that we can try to push for that.
I think you can refer your flying colleagues to Dr. Kevin Anderson, the deputy director of the Tyndall Center. He won't fly anywhere. He took a boat to Iceland for a conference, and he takes trains to Europe, but he's definitely going down that route. And you just touched on a very important question, though, which comes up thousands of times. Isn't it pointless to cut our personal emissions when someone else on the other side of the world will just burn that carbon anyway, or we got to wait for big government action, they say?
Yeah, well, I think it's a really tempting excuse to use to say that, I don't have to change. I'm aware of the problem, but I don't want to change and I don't have to. I'm just going to say that all we need is systems change. If you're trying to make these reductions to keep your own CO2 out of the atmosphere, and that's the main reason you're doing it, it's not really sustainable because you quickly realize, like you said, it's too big of a problem for that, and that's not the way to a solution. But if you frame it as doing all this stuff for cultural shift, then I think it is sustainable, and it feels like you're kind of amplifying these changes through, kind of talking to people, maybe writing about it, and just setting an example, which is shifting the norms. And we have so little time now to avoid the worst effects of climate change that it can feel frustrating. This process of cultural shift is slow. But, over the last year, it's amazing how much has changed, way more than I would have expected. I think what happened was some scientists have started speaking out more, and a lot of Earth scientists are seeing these really frightening changes in the Earth system, didn't quite know how to deal with that, didn't know how to communicate about that. And so some of us are starting to speak out with a greater sense of urgency, with what I would say is an appropriate sense of urgency that the public can understand. And that shifts the norm. Those scientists speaking out, they're fine. Other scientists look at them and say, they're kind of saying the things that I'm thinking or maybe that I'm talking about in private. And so then they start speaking out more too. Then you get an IPCC report, which is making the urgency of the need for action really clear. So that's a special report on 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming, which came out in 2018. And suddenly the youth reads that and they say, wow, this is like a huge existential threat to our lives. So they take to the streets, they form movements, they start to get involved in politics. And suddenly here in the U.S., we have all of the Democratic nominees talking about climate change, which was something that was unheard of just a few years ago. We had presidential entire election cycles where climate change wasn't even mentioned, right? Which for those of us concerned about climate change was extremely frustrating. And this is just the beginning because these movements now, the norms are shifting. I think the early shifts maybe are the hardest shifts. And the impacts are getting more frequent and more intense because that's physics. This is maybe the first social movement which is being driven by underlying physics, which is kind of coming from an exponential increase in CO2 in the atmosphere, right? So that's going to keep increasing until we take action. And if that's driving the social movement, I think it's safe to say that the social movement's only going to get stronger, and politicians and policymakers ignore it at their own peril.
And you end your book with the value of meditation. How does meditation help us deal with this climate angst and maybe our anger that things aren't changing fast enough?
You know, meditation, first of all, it teaches us in a very deep way that we're all connected, and we're connected with non-humans and the natural world too. It's easy to sort of assume that we're separate from everyone else and we're separate from the natural world. You know, the environment is something out there. And that's simply not true. And in a world of sort of accelerating ecological crisis, that becomes more and more clear, right? And then second, meditation gives me the tools to basically kind of be with this difficult knowledge and in kind of acting in this difficult space, but to not necessarily take it so personally, right? So I know, like, I'm limited. I can only do the best that I can do. I can try to advocate for change as skillfully as I can. I can try to do my science as skillfully as I can. And if I get all depressed and sad and anxious, then I'm not going to be as effective, and I'm also not going to be as happy. Yeah, it's a little bit strange to kind of be able to know this and to work in this space and to still be happy.
Well, I want to let you get to your family, so I'll just ask one last question. Let's say our listeners get your message here. They want to start being the change. Can you suggest just a couple of first steps?
I would say the very first thing is to try, if they haven't yet, to try to find a community of like-minded people. This is necessary for sanity. It's necessary for inspiration and for kind of mutual support. So you get ideas from these other people. The one that I joined when I moved to Southern California, and it really helped me, was Citizens Climate Lobby, which pushes for a revenue-neutral carbon fee, which is one of the policy steps that I think we should take. I don't think it's the only thing we should do by a long shot, but I think it's one thing that would be good to do sooner rather than later. So yeah, joining a community like that, I think, is super important, however that comes to pass within a person's community. Talking about this, that kind of goes hand in hand with joining the community, but also starting to talk about this with almost everybody, with coworkers, with family members, educating yourself about what's happening. There's a lot of good ways to do that. There's a website called skepticalscience.com, which is a good place to start. It debunks a lot of the misunderstandings about the changing Earth system. And then in terms of actually reducing one's own fossil fuel use, the best place to start there is to actually try to figure out where those emissions are coming from. My book in Chapter 9 sort of helps you do this, but, like, you know, how much of your emissions is coming from flying versus driving versus food and so forth. I actually made a team. It's a great team with some developers and some other people for an app, which is called Earth Hero. So it's not out yet. It should be out pretty soon, and it'll help make this process easier. And again, framing it in terms of cultural shift as opposed to just keeping emissions out of the air.
We've been speaking with Peter Kalmus. He's a NASA scientist and author of the book Being the Change, Live Well, and Spark a Climate Revolution. I'm going to put links to Peter's website in my show blog at ecoshock.org. And this book is full of charts and tips and step-by-step things, so I really recommend it. Thank you so much, Peter.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Stay tuned for the latest from the young Swedish climate action inspiration, Greta Thunberg. But first, this short report from Brazil. Their own Donald Trump, newly elected President Jair Bolsonaro, is whipping up land grabbers in the Amazon and encouraging violence. There have been three massacres of native Amazonians in the last few weeks, while environmental laws are being tossed out the window. Here is the latest.
Radio EcoShock.
Climate change threatens to destroy the vast Amazon rainforest of South America. But Brazilians may still do it first. Everything from biodiversity, human rights, to rainfall in Africa is at risk. Let's go to one of the most experienced correspondents covering the Amazon. Sue Branford became a journalist in Brazil, reporting for the Financial Times and The Economist. She was Latin America editor for the BBC for 15 years and still returns to Brazil for The Times, The Guardian, and Manga Bay. From London, Sue Branford, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's lovely to talk to you.
We don't get much news out of the Amazon, so tell us about your latest story for Manga Bay.
Well, I think the Amazon should be covered more, because I think what happens in the Amazon is going to affect us all in the world. It's an enormous forest. It covers 2 million square miles, the biggest forest in the world, contains a fifth of the world's drinking water. And I think, really, the fate of the planet is going to be decided in the Amazon. And I was back in the Amazon earlier this year, and I was really quite shocked at the rate of devastation. I first reported, as you said, from the Amazon back in the 1970s when I was working for the Financial Times, when Brazil was ruled by a military dictatorship. And there was a lot of destruction going on then. But it seemed that after Brazil emerged from the dictatorship in 1985 and then had a really progressive new constitution in 1988, that a corner had been turned, that Brazil was beginning a new era in which it was going to respect the biodiversity of the Amazon, it was going to respect the people that lived in the Amazon. But unfortunately, in the last 3 years, a lot of this progress has been overturned, and particularly over the last few months when Brazil has got a very right-wing president, Jair Bolsonaro, who is a fan of the military and is going back to adopting a lot of those outdated policies that the military implemented. And it's causing an awful lot of violence. The latest story I wrote on the Amazon was just a couple of weeks ago, which was about a series of massacres. We're beginning to have landless peasants, indigenous people being massacred on the very edge of the agribusiness frontier that is penetrating the forest. And very little of this is even reported in the Brazilian press. We're getting real impunity, violence. The atmosphere is dreadful in the Amazon now, and it's become a very violent place, a very dangerous place for environmentalists, for activists, for journalists, one of the most dangerous places in the world. I mean, I can go in and out because I'm a foreigner. I don't stay long, but the journalists who are reporting on the ground, the people who are talking to us, they are suffering threats. They're running the risk of their lives, and people are being killed.
But the new Brazilian Minister of Infrastructure sounds rational about building better roads and railways into the Amazon. What's the threat there?
Yes, we interviewed the new Minister of Infrastructure, and he is very rational and he is very well informed, but it is an outdated concept that he has. He's gone back to the concept of development that comes from the 1970s when the military were in power, when nature was seen as an enemy. Nature was seen as something that had to be tamed. The trees had to be cut down. You had to have big development projects. You had to have roads. You had to have dams. You had to have mining projects. You had to harness the wealth of the forest for the development of Brazil. And we know now that this is very short-sighted, that if we go ahead with this model of development, which the current government is, we're going to destroy the world. I mean, we need these forests. We've learned an awful lot. The scientists have learned an awful lot over the last 40 years. They know that the Amazon plays a key role in regulating the climate, in producing oxygen, in harnessing the whole process of the way the climate works. And we start interfering with this, we could actually destroy the forest. Something like 20% of the, or just under 20% of the forest has been felled. And if the scientists now think that if something like 25%, a quarter of the forest is felled, then we're going to spark off, we're going to have a turning point, we're going to turn this forest into a savanna. And once the forest starts dying, then it's going to upset the world climate catastrophically. And this is something we should not be doing. Apart from, of course, if you go on cutting down the forest, you're generating a lot of greenhouse gases just because of the trees that when they rot, produce a lot of these greenhouse gases. And I think there's a growing awareness in the world now that we need to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases that we produce. Well, we're already really on a process of very alarming climate change, and we've got to reduce the production of these greenhouse gases. And one of the first steps, surely, that we should be doing is stopping cutting down trees. This is the sort of easy fruit that we can pick. And yet the rate at which the forest has been felled has picked up alarmingly over the last 2 or 3 years.
Sue, has the massive dream of damming most of the Amazon rivers for electricity been scaled back or called off?
Well, again, we thought it had been, but with the new government, they're talking about picking up this program again. I mean, when I was first in Brazil, it seemed a very good idea to sort of dam these rivers and produce energy. But now we know that these big dams in tropical conditions cause quite serious environmental problems. And they also disrupt the lives of many indigenous communities. And one of the things that has become very clear over the last few decades, the best people for preserving, protecting the forest are the indigenous groups. If you fly over eastern Amazonia now, which is the most devastated area, often you're flying over areas which are devastated brown, a lot of felled areas, and then you come across what looks like an island of green. And almost inevitably, that is an indigenous reserve. They have, over millennia, thousands of years, they've learned how to coexist with the forest, to use the wealth of the forest, and yet to protect it, to make sure it's in a healthy state. And in fact, they need the forest to be in a healthy state for their culture, for their way of life to be preserved. And when you start having these big projects, the dams and the mining projects, their way of life, their communities are very seriously harmed. And I think one of the things we're seeing now is that the Indians themselves are getting more organized and more determined to stop these big projects. There recently, there was a big dam, Belo Monte, on the Xingu River that was completed. It's the third largest hydroelectric dam in the world. And before it was built, the authorities went in and assured the Indians that their way of life would be protected. Although the dam was quite close, they wouldn't really suffer any big impact. But now the Indians are seeing that this was wrong, that their rivers are greatly impoverished, that they can't go on hunting, their whole way of life has been disturbed. I mean, they're not going hungry. The government is coming and giving them food parcels. So this is not how the Indians want to live. And very sadly, some of these indigenous communities, you have quite a high rate of obesity and of Western diseases, of cancer, of overweight, of the whole kind of illness that we in the West suffer from. And the Indians are quite horrified to see that some of their communities have these problems. And they are now adamant that they're not going to let the authorities go ahead and go back to this old ambitious program of building big dams and opening big mineral projects. But this is what the new government of Jair Bolsonaro wants. He is an open fan of, he said repeatedly that he's a fan of the military. And many people sort of thought that this was a sort of exaggeration, that he didn't really mean it. But now we actually see that he did mean it, that he is very hardline. He wants to get the Indians off the land. He's gone back to that old kind of army rhetoric of the objective is to integrate, to assimilate the Indians. And a lot of the ministers in his new government are saying that the Indians have got to become Brazilians. They've got to give up their way of life, their culture, and they've got to become one of us. And, I mean, this is a very short-sighted view, and it was something Brazilians thought they'd left behind with this new constitution in 1988, which explicitly said that recognized that the Indians were the original inhabitants of Brazil and they had the right to their land, and that the Indians had a right to their own way of life, to their own culture, to their own language. And there was a recognition of the enormous benefits that this brings to Brazil, but both in terms of increasing the complexity, the cultural wealth of the country, but also in terms of environmental protection and of protecting the environment. So it's been quite a shock now to have a sort of president in power who explicitly is rejecting this and going back to very different, outdated views.
Yes, those are the views we had in Canada. We were going to make all the First Nations people into white people. We took away their children and put them in residential schools. It ended up being a kind of genocide for them. And, of course, the same thing happened in the United States in the 1800s, early 1900s. A terrible path to go down and terrible news to hear. Now, you recently wrote for Mongabe about the big state of Rondônia in northern Brazil. Tell us about the seesaw struggle to protect at least some of nature there.
Well, Rondônia is on the very west of the Amazon border. It's a very remote area, and the news filters out very slowly there. And it's an area which has a lot of mineral wealth, has a lot of trees. And now that we've got a government in power that has said that it's not really going to make sure the laws are respected, that it's going to not take action if land grabbers and farmers go in. We've had cases of farmers moving in and land grabbers moving in and actually intimidating and killing some of the inhabitants there and some of the Indians there. What we're seeing now is the worst cases of violence occurring on the very edge of the Amazon frontier, where you've got, first of all, the loggers moving in, trying to take out the good timber, and then behind them, you've got the land grabbers who go in and sort of and fell the forest, and once it's cleared, they then sell it on to ranchers, and then behind them is agribusiness. And there's long been conflicts between these incomers and the traditional inhabitants who are trying to cling on to their land, and also landless peasants who, in many of these areas, have now got land settlements authorized by the government. But the land grabbers want to get their hands on this land again. And one of the other things that is happening, that there have been promises by the government, they're going to build, first of all, a big new road that would go right across the South America into Peru and join up with the ocean there. So we'll have the whole of Latin America traversed by a road. And this, of course, is leading to an increase in land values, because now that farmers and loggers can see that they can get their products to the market much more quickly, they want to get their hands on this land. And there's been resistance both by traditional communities of Brazil nuts collectors, of peasant farmers, and of the Indians, who really are struggling to hold on to their land. And the agribusiness, which is driving it all, is very powerful. And now it's the most powerful force in the Brazilian political scene. It dominates both the executive and the legislative arms of government. It's become much more powerful in the last couple of years because it was through its support of this rural lobby in Congress. First of all, the president was impeached in 2016, and now President Bolsonaro was elected. So they are very powerful in Congress. So they're pushing ahead at full speed with a lot of these destructive policies that under earlier governments had gone more slowly and there had been more effective opposition. And I also think that the agribusiness lobby is fearful that the Bolsonaro government is fairly unstable. I mean, he's been in power for just over 100 days, and the opinion polls are showing that support for him is falling very rapidly. I think he was one of these, perhaps a little bit like Trump, that he came across to the Brazilian voter as somebody authentic, who spoke off the cuff, who wasn't a traditional politician, that was somebody in some way real. And so they voted for him. But a lot of his views don't really chime with the majority views of most Brazilians. Most Brazilians are in favor of preserving biodiversity, are in favor of allowing the Indians to stay on their land. So they're finding that they are out of step with the president. Of course, he has got important supporters who are still backing him. But there's a growing number of Brazilians who are feeling uncomfortable with his rhetoric, with the way in which he's sort of justifying going in for landlords. He says landowners should arm themselves and go in and get rid of people whose land they want. He's quite openly espousing these views, which really don't get an awful lot of support with Brazilians. So I think agribusiness is trying very hard to push ahead with measures that it's wanted for years, things like allowing big mining companies onto indigenous land, to allow agribusiness onto indigenous land. So we're seeing the momentum of bills going through Congress, of change, going very fast at the moment. And I think it is driven by this feeling that this is a window of opportunity for agribusiness, and they've got to go seize their opportunity because it may not last very long. But it is extremely worrying because the amount of damage that they can do in these months, years that they're in power is extraordinary. And I mean, I just read today a scientist saying if the way that they're allowing land grabbers and landowners onto the forest land now, we may see just by 2030 that over half of the Amazon forest has been felled. And if we get to that point, then we're going to have a major disruption in the global climate. And this way, I think it is what is going on in the Amazon is really important for all of us, because it's if we just have this sort of rampant destruction of the forest in the Amazon, then the whole problem of controlling climate change, of stopping the world on this, what seems to be at the moment a fairly sort of headlong gallop into uncontrollable climatic change, all that's going to become much more difficult.
Following reporting from MongaBay.com, we've been getting an update from seasoned Brazil correspondent Sue Branford. Find links to her latest story in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Sue, thank you so much for talking with us.
A pleasure, Alex.
This is 15-year-old climate activist and school striker Greta Thunberg addressing the European Parliament on April 16, 2019. You need to hear this.
My name is Greta Thunberg. I am 16 years old. I come from Sweden, and I want you to panic. I want you to act as if the house was on fire. I have said those words before, and a lot of people has explained why that is a bad idea. A great number of politicians have told me that panic never leads to anything good. And I agree, to panic unless you have to is a terrible idea. But when your house is on fire and you want to keep your house from burning to the ground, then that does require some level of panic. Our civilization is so fragile, it is almost like a castle built in the sand. The facade is so beautiful, but the foundations are far from solid. We have been cutting so many corners. Yesterday, the world watched with despair and enormous sorrow how the Notre Dame burnt in Paris. Some buildings are more than just buildings. But the Notre Dame will be rebuilt. I hope that its foundations are strong. I hope that our foundations are even stronger. But I fear they are not. Around the year 2030, 10 years, 259 days and 10 hours away from now, we will be in a position where we set off an irreversible chain reaction that will most likely lead to the end of our civilization as we know it. That is, unless in that time, permanent and unprecedented changes in all aspects of society have taken place, including a reduction of our CO2 emissions by at least 50%. And please note that these calculations are depending on inventions that have not been yet invented at scale. Inventions that are supposed to clear our atmosphere of astronomical amounts of carbon dioxide. Furthermore, do these calculations not include unforeseen tipping points and feedback loops, like the extremely powerful methane gas escaping from rapidly thawing Arctic permafrost? Nor do they include already locked-in warming hidden by air pollution, nor the aspect of equity or climate justice clearly stated throughout the Paris Agreement, which is absolutely necessary to make it work on a global scale. We must also bear in mind that these are just calculations, estimations. That means that these points of no return may occur a bit sooner or later than that. No one can know for sure. We can, however, be certain that they will occur approximately in these time frames, because these calculations are not opinions or wild guesses. These projections are backed up by scientific facts concluded by all nations through the IPCC. Nearly every major national scientific body around the world unreservedly supports the work and findings of the IPCC. We are in the midst of the sixth mass extinction, and the extinction rate is up to 10,000 times faster than what is considered normal, with up to 200 species becoming extinct every single day. Erosion of fertile topsoil, deforestation of our great forests, toxic air pollution, loss of insects and wildlife, the acidification of our oceans. These are all disastrous trends being accelerated by a way of life that we, here in our financially fortunate part of the world, see as our right to simply carry on. But hardly anyone knows about these catastrophes, or understand how they are just the first few symptoms of climate ecological breakdown. Because how could they? They have not been told. Or more importantly, they have not been told by the right people and in the right way. Our house is falling apart, and our leaders need to start acting accordingly. Because at the moment they are not. If our house was falling apart, our leaders wouldn't go on like you do today. You would change almost every part of your behavior, as you do in an emergency. If our house was falling apart, you wouldn't fly around the world in business class chatting about how the market will solve everything with clever small solution to specific isolated problems. You wouldn't talk about buying and building your way out of a crisis that has been created by buying and building things. If our house was falling apart, you wouldn't hold three emergency Brexit summits and no emergency summit regarding the breakdown of the climate and environment. You wouldn't be arguing about phasing out coal in 15 or 11 years. If our house was falling apart, you wouldn't be celebrating that one single nation like Ireland may soon divest from fossil fuels. You wouldn't celebrate that Norway has decided to stop drilling for oil outside the scenic resort of Lofoten Island, but will continue to drill for oil everywhere else for decades. It's 30 years too late for that kind of celebrations. If our house was falling apart, the media wouldn't be writing about anything else. The ongoing climate and ecological crisis would make up all the headlines. If our house was falling apart, you wouldn't say that you have the situation under control and place the future living conditions for all species in the hands of inventions that are yet to be invented. And you would not spend all your time as a politician arguing about taxes or Brexit. If the walls of our house truly came tumbling down, surely you would set your differences aside and start cooperating. Well, our house is falling apart, and we are rapidly running out of time. And yet, basically nothing is happening. Everyone and everything needs to change So why waste precious time arguing about what and who needs to change first? Everyone and everything has to change, but the bigger your platform, the bigger your responsibility. The bigger your carbon footprint, the bigger your moral duty. When I tell politicians to act now, the most common answer is that they can't do anything drastic because that will be too unpopular among the voters. And they are right, of course, since most people are not even aware of why those changes are required. That is why I keep telling you to unite behind the science. Make the best available science at the heart of politics and democracy. The EU elections are coming up soon. And many of us who will be affected the most by this crisis, people like me, are not allowed to vote. Nor are we in a position to shape the decisions of business, politics, engineering, media, education, or science. Because the time it takes for us to educate ourselves to do that simply does no longer exist. And that is why millions of children are taking it to the streets, school striking for the climate to create attention for the climate crisis. You need to listen to us, we who cannot vote. You need to vote for us, for your children and grandchildren. What we are doing now can soon no longer be undone. In this election, you vote for the future living conditions for humankind. And though the politics needed do not exist today, some alternatives are certainly less worse than others. And I have read that some parties do not even want me standing here today because they so desperately do not want to talk about climate breakdown. Our house is falling apart. The future, as well as what we have achieved in the past, is literally in your hands now. But it's still not too late to act. It will take a far-reaching vision. It will take courage. It will take fierce determination to act now, to lay the foundations where we may not know all the details about how to shape the ceiling. In other words, it will take cathedral thinking. I ask you to please wake up and make the changes required possible. To do your best is no longer good enough. We must all do the seemingly possible. And it's okay if you refuse to listen to me. I am, after all, just a 16-year-old schoolgirl from Sweden. But you cannot ignore the scientists or the science. Or the millions of school-striking children who are school-striking for the right to a future. I beg you, please do not fail on this.
That was Greta Thunberg speaking to the EU Parliament on April 16. Find a link to the video in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. With the cathedral gone, it is my confession time. Lately, I am discouraged. After 13 years of helping to communicate climate danger directly from the world's great scientists on radio, we are still drifting towards the black hole of a superheated world where most species perish. Climate programs like mine are still a niche on the fringe. I'm chronically broke, chronically sore, and wonder why I carry on. That is also how I feel about the failure of American democracy to defend itself against a takeover by big money, right-wing politics, and foreign governments. I thought there might still be some justice left. Now I feel naive, again. But remember, while mainstream media carries us on through each country's passion play of politics and corruption, we suck up the wild spaces, and we fill every living belly with microplastic. That is the real cathedral burning down daily, the cathedral of life. Let our actions, large and small, be our prayers for salvation. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for being brave enough to keep listening to Radio EcoShock.
People around here don't know what it means to see. suffer at the hands of our American dreams, turn their backs on the grisly scenes, traced to the privileged sons. They got their God, they got their guns, got their armies and the chosen ones. But we'll all be burning in the same big sun when the great correction